then touched helmets with me. "Hook the motor back up, kid," he said. "I think that'll hold till we're on the ground again." The antenna ran up and down slickly. Lubricating the joint no doubt helped, but not enough to mention. The problem had been the worn gear. Barnes and I locked through at the end of the watch with Bondurant and Cern, who were arguing about the relative merits of the prostitutes to be had on Bryce and Plaisance. Garden variety streetwalkers, I gathered. Neither man sounded as though he had refined tastes. Bryce and Plaisance were powerful members of the Alliance of Free Stars, and not common destinations for Cinnabar citizens. Very few people on Xenos could have joined in the discussion. It demonstrated that experience didn't equate with culture. To Barnes, as the lock filled, I said, "Will those cotter pins hold up?"
"Long enough," he said, shrugging in his hard suit. "I didn't feel like swapping out the pulley and the matrix when we'll be on the surface in a couple watches."
He grinned broadly.
"You already proved you could string a cable," he said, "and that's what it'd take to replace the whole set."
The lock opened. In the rotunda, I began undoing my suit. Barnes, Bondurant, and Cern got theirs off quickly. The common spacers were arguing fine points that I couldn't even understand. I was all right with my ignorance. Wotchens came out of the companionway, saw me, and braced my shoulder as I got my legs clear.
"Hey, kid," she said, "we ought to be on Santiago in a couple hours. Got any plans for there?"
"No, ma'am," I said over my shoulder as I hung up my suit. "Do you want me to swap watches with somebody?"
"Not that," said the bosun. She looked away. "Look, kid, would you let me take you to dinner? I'll pay, only you gotta pick the place."
I guess my face went blank. The gods know my mind did.
"Oh, bloody hell, not that," Wotchen said.
I swear to heaven she was blushing.
"Look, not that you're not cute, but I like him a little better growed. Naw, I just want to talk with you where we can. I owe you for Breckenridge, you know."
"You don't owe me anything," I said. "We're shipmates."
"But I'm not proud. I'll let you buy me dinner. Or whatever it is when we land."
"Thanks, kid," she said as she strode the companionways again.
"Remember, you picked the place."
I went onto the bridge to see what Officer Mundy had for me. I hoped that she'd found information on restaurants not too far from the harbor. That hadn't been one of the things I'd been worried about. Chapter 12. Captain Leary brought us down in the harbor at Santiago, the capital of the planet of the same name. He put me in the striker seat just as he had when Lieutenant Ennery landed on Hansen's world. I thought Ennery's landing was flawless. I thought the same of the captain's. I was no expert, but both were a lot smoother than the computer landings I experienced in jaunts to orbit and back in training. Seeing it done right made me even more determined to leave the job to the computer, at least until I'd had several more years of training on simulators. After landing, I went to my cabin to change for Liberty. The boarding hold was already full of spacers going on leave, but they'd be wearing utilities. I was changing out of uniform. The Sunray was a commercial vessel, but she was run on RCN lines by RCN personnel, and I didn't intend to give myself any breaks. I decided to wear an outfit different from what I'd worn on Hansen's world. Dark brown slacks and a matching jacket over a bright yellow tunic. As I sealed the shirt seam, someone knocked on the door panel.
"Just a second," I called, tucking in the shirt tail.
I strolled to the panel. I figured that Wotchens had gotten through with the docking procedures more quickly than she'd expected to. There was no reason for the bosun to superintend rolling out the extension bridge with a crew as experienced as this one. She and both her mates had been present to check me out in the lounge. A senior rigger was probably in charge on the hull, but they were all senior riggers. Wotchens liked to do it, though. I opened the panel. Maeve smiled at me. She said, "I decided that the hull wasn't the best place for us to get acquainted. Would you like to go to dinner tonight? I hear that Santiago has some nice places." She was wearing a bodysuit, black with sudden silvery highlights. It wasn't at all tight, but the ways it clung and slipped would have gotten any man's attention. It sure got mine. "I'm very sorry, Maeve," I said. "I've already made a dinner engagement for tonight." Maeve looked startled, then smiled warmly.
"Well, there'll be another time," she said. "I hope so, anyway."
Her eyes narrowed slightly, and she added, "With Lieutenant Ennery, I suppose. She's had some bad luck and certainly deserves some fun in her life." I thought I heard condescension in Maeve's voice.
I found the first officer unsettling to be around, but the sneer, maybe I imagined it, maybe, made me angry on Ennery's account, even though she wasn't present to hear it. "No, mistress," I said as calmly as I could. "I'm having dinner with the chief of rig tonight. Bosun Wochens, you know." It suddenly struck me that I didn't know Wochens' first name. I'll ask her tonight, though I don't suppose it really matters. "I don't think I know," Maeve said. Her smile slipped. "Oh. Oh." When the smile returned, it was as false as a politician's. "Well, another time, as I said." She turned and strode very quickly to the companionway. I couldn't have offended her so badly if I'd slapped her face. But you shouldn't treat people that way, even if you're pretty and they never were, even before they got burned. I put on the jacket I'd laid on the bed. Then I went to the bridge and chatted with Corey while I waited for Wochens to get off duty. According to the information from Monday, there was a museum of the settlement in Santiago. It didn't sound like much, but I'd try it tomorrow if I had time to. Far planets were a new experience to me. I might get blasé about them, but I didn't think so. Wochens stuck her head onto the bridge and said that she was going to change and would be back in a jiff. "No rush," I called to her back. I didn't expect to make a long night of it. Corey was telling me about visiting public works departments when they landed on new planets, the ones organized enough to have such things. His father was a paving contractor on their home world of Florentine, and it gave Corey a feeling of comfort to talk shop. I thought about the sudden wash of homesickness when I'd walked into Apex Outfitters. I wondered if I could arrange to negotiate with all suppliers as long as I was aboard the Sunray. "Okay, kid," Wochens called from the hatchway. "Where are we going to dinner?" I looked at her. "A place called the Plum Bob," I said. "But what happened to your Liberty suit?" She was wearing new utilities, tailored but otherwise unadorned. Wochens looked away. "Well," she said, "you know, I appreciate what you did in Breckenridge, but I don't want to embarrass you." "Wochens," I said, "put your bloody Liberty suit on. I'm not taking us anywhere they won't serve spacers. And if I've figured wrong, we'll bloody well go somewhere else." Wochens looked blank for a moment. "Yes, sir," she said, and trotted for her cabin. When she was out of sight, Corey chuckled slightly. "You know, Roy," he said, "I wasn't sure you were really cut out to be an officer. Guess I was wrong to wonder." Wochens was back in a moment, bright and fluttering. We headed down to the boarding hold and out. I turned left at the street along the harbor, saying, "It's about 6 blocks, mostly west, but a block in from the harbor, that's north." "Then let's take the block inland first," Wochens said. "Along the street by the harbor, it runs to warehouses and factories, even beyond where it dives. Most of the places I've been, I mean." "That's better than what I've got," I said, changing direction to cross the street. "All I have is a map." We crossed as a couple of heavy trucks rolled past, one in either direction. They weren't moving fast. "The information I've got is about 3 years old," I said. "The place I'm looking for may not be around." "Kid, I don't care," Wochens said. "Not a scrap. I just wanted it to be you picking, not me." The traffic along the street we were following was steady but not fast. The standard local vehicle had 4 tall wheels and a squarish box on top of them. It seemed to me that if one hit us, the car would be worse off than we were, though they were probably sturdier than they looked. Wochens shook herself. She kneaded her pectoral muscles with both hands. I could loan her my jacket as a drape over her shoulders. It wouldn't fit, of course. I was finding the evening a little nippy myself. Wochens saw me looking at her and said, "It's just the muscles still tighten up when it gets cold. I'm fine. The weather here is warmer than lots of places I've been." "Ah," I said. "You were shot several times in the chest and returned to duty?" "You're bloody right I did," Wochens said. "It was just a dumb mistake. I wasn't fast enough getting through a doorway. There was a medicomp in the next bloody room." "Right," I said, nodding in fierce agreement. "You don't suggest to anybody that they can't do their job, and suggesting that to somebody like Wochens could be, well, dangerous." And I hadn't meant to do that. But it had come out that way to her just because it was such a hot button. I chuckled. To explain it, I said aloud, "Bloody hell, woman, who'd be dumb enough to say that you couldn't do your job?" What I'd really been thinking was that I'd known being an RCN officer was dangerous. I hadn't guessed that asking a simple question about information a shipmate had volunteered might be one of those dangers. "Nobody who didn't want to learn how far I could throw them through the next wall," Wochens said. She laughed as well, but I was pretty sure that it was also the cold truth.
I'd gotten a break because she liked me, and she was sure I hadn't meant anything by it. The sign of the place where the plumb bob was supposed to be now read Catch of the Day, with a leaping fish which seemed to have fins sticking out in four directions. Are you up for seafood? I said. I guess they changed their menu since Officer Mundy got her information. Sure, that's fine, Wochen said. Say, that fish looks just like a ship, don't it? The fins really did stick out from the fish's body the way antennas did from a starship's hull in The Matrix. It wasn't a connection I'd have made, but I hadn't spent my working life as a rigger. The doors pulled open. The head waiter's station was set just back from the entrance. It could have been in Zenos, or in Breckenridge, or I suspect anywhere people weren't too close to the edge. A city with a busy starport has at least modest comforts for the locals, as well as with the sort of establishments that serve spacers. A table for two, I said to the dapper little man, who turned a professional smile on us. More than half the seats were filled, but the place wasn't packed yet. A booth, if that's possible. And I get the bill, said Wochens. She didn't exactly shout, but her voice from just behind and above made me jump. Lucinda will seat you, madam and master, said the head waiter. His smile was a little wider, and I thought it had become real. He thinks I'm Wochen's gigolo, I realized. We followed a pert young woman, a slightly younger, female edition of the head waiter, to a booth at the back. Sorry, kid, Wochens muttered. Hope I didn't embarrass you. I just didn't want you to forget what I said. Of course you didn't embarrass me, I lied. But I've looked at the prices, and I guarantee I could handle it. Yeah, well, you're not going to, Wochens said, taking the opposite side of the booth after I slid onto a bench. I've made plenty in prizes, serving as bosun to six. And I pissed away some of it, sure. I've got three sisters, all of them married, and none of the husbands worth the powder to blow them away. She grinned. I kept some for myself, though. You bet your ass I did. The server made the usual offers. I didn't know enough about local food to make a competent choice, so I chose the peppered ragfish special. It sounded interesting, so why not? And a glass of the house white. Wochens ordered the same, only she'd drink gin with a peppermint candy. To my amazement, the server was no more surprised by that than she had been by my wine. I was broadening my horizons, though Wochen's choice wasn't a taste I expected to cultivate myself. Two questions, Wochens, I said as we waited for our drinks. I was raising my voice a little to be heard over the other diners and the bustle of servers. The bar on one side of the building was already crowded. Shoot, she said. What's your first name, I said. I'm Roy, but Kid works fine. I guess you're going to stay Kid, Wochens said. That's just how you come through. I'm sorry, I guess. But you just do. That's the breaks, I said. There's worse. But your name? I'm Ellie, Wochens said. But nobody but my family calls me that. Blood family, I mean. With the sissies, I'm chief. She threw her shoulders back on the bench. Two questions, she said. What's the other? What the bloody hell do you want from me? I said, not letting my voice change from when I asked her name. Wochens looked blank for a moment. Then she began laughing. Her laughter was loud enough and harsh enough that people were turning to look at our booth. The drinks came. Wochens downed half her gin, then smiled at me. Okay, kid, she said. I want to know what you're doing here. You're not like anybody I've seen before. Just tell me what you're up to. You want it straight, I said. I was in the academy, but my dad was Dean Olfetri. He was bribing politicians and Navy House bureaucrats to rob the RCN blind. So I dropped out of the academy, did some scut work, and I took the first decent job I was offered, which was by Captain Leary, who brought me here. I sucked my lips in, then said, are you shocked? Want me to buy my own dinner now? I guess your old man isn't the first crooked outfitter I've heard of, Wochens said. The cable you replaced the first day out was from a reel marked with the right size, but there was a ring around the hub to make up for the cable's smaller diameter. She drank again, then thought about it and emptied the glass. She held it high, which I took as a silent request for a refill. Go on, kid, she said. Maybe it was Dad doing so much work with the RCN, I said. I don't know. Both Junior and I wanted to be RCN officers, though. He was killed at New Harmony. I frowned as I tried to focus my mind on a past that had changed completely since my father's death. Look, I said, I know I don't seem like an RCN officer, but I could have been one. I was trying to put words to things I'd thought for years, but hadn't been willing to say even to myself. because it had seemed like whining. My brother had the look. I know what you mean, I said. He partied, and he was everybody's drinking buddy. And if you passed out trying to drink along with him, he'd pull your girlfriend sure as lead sinks. But my navigation was better than Junior's, and I could take him apart on the tactical simulator, even when I was 12 and he was an academy graduate. The server did indeed arrive with a gin and a peppermint candy that Wochens cracked with the back of a spoon. The bosun put half in her cheek and sipped at her drink. She said, Barnes said you did a good job re-rigging Dorsal B. I shrugged. Barnes and Dossie could have done the job in half the time, I said. I've watched them work. Wochens smiled broadly. The server, arriving with our meals, shied back, though I'm not sure she had anything to do with Wochens' expression. Barnes and Dossie have been working rigging for a long time, Wochens said. Either one could be a bosun on a cruiser if he wanted to. Besides, Barn was laying back to see how you'd handle the job. You could be on a battleship, Ellie, I said. Why aren't you? Wochens laughed again. I've been on a battleship, she said. She cut a big bite of fish, guiding it to her mouth with both fork and the tip of her knife. My first tour as an able spacer was on the Renown. Didn't like it worth a damn. Seemed like the Admiral was always looking over my shoulder. Transferred to destroyers, then got a slot as bosun's mate on a courier ship, the Aglaia. Best luck I ever hoped to have. The ragfish was pretty good, though bland to my taste. The peppers were strands of bell pepper, not the hot pepper I'd expected. You like the courier ship that much? I said to keep the conversation going. It was bloody awful, Wochens said, shoveling the rest of her fish into her mouth. You not only have extra ship's officers, you got the passengers like as not nosing into your business. But that's where I met Six, and I've been with him ever since. I was taking longer to finish my meal than Wochens had. For that matter, I still had half a glass of wine, and she was ordering her third gin. I said, because of the prizes, I said. I guess all the crew who've served with Captain Leary are pretty rich by now. Wochens laughed, but without the enthusiasm that had rattled the windows before. Most of the sissies, they've got maybe a pot to piss in, kid, she said. They're spacers. The ones who've got more. Pasternak got a regular manor back in Wasail County where he grew up. It don't do them no good. It don't do me no good, except if I want to take a kid to dinner to learn what makes him tick. I don't worry what the tab's going to be. She paused and pursed her lips. We sissies are all spacers, she said. Every single soul who's stuck with Six is that. And you don't need money to be a spacer. If you sign with Six to get rich, you're a bloody fool. You're more likely to lose your arm or your ass than to get rich. I joined to be a spacer, I said. I'm learning to do that. I'll never be the astrogator that Captain Leary and even Corey are. But I'll be better than I am now, and eventually I'll be pretty good. I shrugged. My glass was empty, so I held it up the way Wochens had hers. I know there's risks, I said. They told us not to open the coffin when they shipped Junior back for burial. Mom thought that meant his body had been torn up, and maybe Dad thought that too. But I heard the gravel rattle when I shifted the coffin a little. Junior had been burned so bad they had to ballast the coffin before they sent it back. But he'd been a spacer, and I'm going to be a spacer. My wine came. I took a deep draft, I guess to cool myself off. I'd gotten pretty hot talking like that. That stuff any good? Wochens said. It's all right for me, I said. I'm not much of a drinker. But I can tell you, my fiancé's father wouldn't use it to clean drains. Ex-fiancé. Toss it down and let's get out of here, Wochens said. We'll find a place near the harbor and really tie one on if you like. I didn't. I peeled off when the bosun stopped at a place on the harbor front. But I went back aboard the Sunray, feeling that it had been a good evening. My astrogation was improving faster than it ever would have if I'd stayed in the academy, and I'd gotten through another test. I guess the test would keep coming till I died. Well, that was all right. Chapter 13 My last watch before Saguntum was in the power room. Captain Leary believed that an officer had to know the whole ship, not just the rigging and how to astrogate. One of the things Pasternak's list had directed me to buy on Hansen's World was a flow pump. This wasn't the big unit which sucked water into the reaction mass tanks. It was a relatively small pump submerged in the tank to feed the fluid to the plasma thrusters or to the antimatter converters for the high drive, depending on which we were using at the time.
Got a job for you, kid, said Pasternak when I reported. You and Gamba are going to be replacing the flow pump, and I don't mind telling you that it'll be a bitch of a job.
It was that in truth. Pasternak had run the tank down lower than he said he liked, but me and Gamba, a Tech 4, had to wear air suits working inside in 4 feet of water to remove frozen bolts. Sometime in the last few years, the Sunray had filled its tanks with water which was either contaminated with something more corrosive than salt, or which perhaps wasn't water at all. Any fluid which would feed through the lines became reaction mass so far as the propulsion units were concerned. The pump was supposed to be a sealed unit, but Pasternak said it had been running hot ever since we lifted from Xenos because of a corroded rotor shaft. The lock nuts, the bolts were welded to the tank, had long given up any pretense of having corrosion-resistant coatings. When we got the pump loose, I released the short line that clamped me to the inflow grating in the tank floor. Without those tethers, we'd have been bobbing like corks in our air suits. I opened the faceplate and called, "We got it loose! We're ready to haul it out!" I expected somebody to bring a chain hoist above the open lid of the tank. Instead, a tech named Evans leaned over the side and gripped the output pipe. It had been unhooked from the manifold. "Keep out of the way," Evans said. He tilted the pipe to make sure the pump really was free of all the bolts, then slid it toward him in the tank. Finally, he lifted the pump hand over hand until he could rest it on the lip. "Now you boys just sit there, and you can put the new one back on," Evans grunted. He swung the pump to the deck and disappeared for a moment. "Bloody hell," I said to Gamba. It also opened his helmet. "I know what that thing weighs." "Yeah, Evans is showing off for the new officer," Gamba said. He was as overqualified for this job as Barnes had been to act as my helper in restringing a cable. His ears were the smallest I'd ever seen on an adult man. "Mind, he's got a lot to show off. He's thick as a brick, though." "With Captain Leary on the bridge," I said, "the rest of us don't need to be brilliant." Shuffling and heavy thumps indicated that something was happening on the deck above us. Then I heard the squeals and bangs of a crate being broken up. Beaumont, a Tech 3, leaned over and called, "Just a second more. We gotta hook up the exit pipe." "We're not going anywhere," I said. I wondered if Gamba and me would even be able to get out by ourselves. Maybe if I was strong enough to haul myself up from Gamba's shoulders, and then strong enough to pull him up in turn. But I'd use a rope or a length of cable for that, not just reaching down and grabbing him by the hand. "Stand clear," somebody shouted. Then a new pump appeared over the rim and descended into the tank, faster than the old one had risen, but still under control. It hit the water with enough of a splash that I was glad I'd closed up my helmet again. There'd been several techs skidding the new unit along the decking, but Evans had apparently decided to lower it alone. I wouldn't get in his way about any bloody thing he wanted to do. Gamba and I walked the new unit over to the mounting plate on its edge. The trick then was to align it with the bolts. Gamba grinned at me. "It's on you now, kid," he said. "Right," I said. "But look, you get over against the side, okay? I'll come up and ask for help if I have to." I couldn't honestly think of anything a second man could do that would be useful. But I don't want to lose a hand if the pump moves while I'm between it and the bottom. "Right, kid," Gamba said with a serious expression. He at least knew to look like he was as concerned as I was. The corner of his mouth quirked. "Besides," he said, "I think Wochenson'd pull my arms off if anything like that happened." "I'll be done as quick as I can," I said, and closed my face shield. Mostly to get on with the job, but I didn't want to talk about me and Wochens either. Mind, there was nothing to talk about anyway. I hooked to the grating again. My helmet still bobbed, but I could keep my arms and torso underwater. I rotated the pump so that the flange was up on one of the four bolts, then used a screwdriver through another hole to crab the unit onto the remaining three bolts. Now was when I really could have used some help, but only if we could have communicated. I grabbed the outflow pipe with both hands and turned it carefully, like it was an analog clock. This would have been a lot easier if I were strong as Evans was, but I'm not sure I'd ever met anybody else that strong. I heard a click and felt the pipe wobble. I straightened and opened my face shield. "Okay, Gamba," I said. "I got it balanced here. Now we just need to line it up with the bolts and let it fall home." Gamba grinned at me. "Keep your hands on the pipe, kid," he said. "But you just feel. Make sure your boots aren't in the way, right?" "Right," I said, and shuffled back a boot's length. I'd asked for help, not to have Gamba take over. On the other hand, I was so exhausted that I didn't really care. The pipe tilted one way and another, turning by equally tiny bits under my gloves. It suddenly gaved and clanged to its seat. Gamba stepped back. He was breathing hard, so it hadn't really been as easy as he'd made it seem. "Got the old nuts, kid?" he asked. Sure, I said. I reached for them, right here in my pouch. Leave them and throw them away when we're out of this, Gambas said. He held up a little net bag with four bright finished nuts. We'll use these instead because we can. That'll make it easier for the next couple bastards. It won't be us, I hope to hell. It was a lot easier to snug the nuts up than it had been to crack them loose to begin with. That would have been true even if Gamba hadn't given me a power wrench small enough to hold in my hand, instead of using the box wrench I'd taken them off with. As a matter of fact, the biggest problem screwing the nuts on was keeping hold of the wrench against the torque. Beaumont hooked a tubular ladder over the side. I climbed up behind Gamba. It was long past the end of the watch. I was wrung out, as I generally was since I joined the Sunray. I wasn't complaining, but I'd never have worked this hard at a regular civilian job. I walked to the entrance of the power room and started to take off my air suit near the lockers there. The bulkhead was armored, like that of the bridge. It wouldn't exactly withstand the blast of a ruptured fusion bottle, but it should redirect the fireball through the deliberately weakened vent plates in the exterior hull. Pasternak gestured me to come over to his enclosed office across from the lockers. I closed the hatch behind me because of the racket. Four techs were guiding the lid back over the tank, using the traveling hoist. The power room was noisy enough at any time, but the clanking and shouts made it something out of hell.
Six wants to see you on the bridge, kid, Pasternak said.
Thanks, Chief, I said. What I was really thinking was, no bloody way. I chuckled as I finished removing the air suit. I couldn't even complain about it not being fair. I was a volunteer.
There you are, old Fetri, Captain Leary said, rotating his couch at the console to face me as I entered the bridge. Say, you've got a nice suit, right?
Well, I've got a suit, I said. Several of them. But I left all my dress clothes in Pawn and Xenos. By now they'd probably have been sold. Well, I couldn't imagine I'd ever again have entree to society in which they'd be required. I might have gotten a few extra florins if I'd flat sold them instead of pawning them, but at the time I did it, I hadn't really internalized how complete my disaster was.
They're civilian, the captain said, smiling, and I suspect anybody else aboard would call them dress clothes.
He frowned across at the commo station and added, well, maybe not Adele. Looking at me again, he said, anyway, the delegation needs an escort of five spacers when they present their credentials in Saguntum, and I need an officer to command the escort. You're what I've got with civilian clothes.
Ah, I said. I had nowhere to go with the thought, so I said, yes, sir, and shut my mouth.
I don't believe you've met our passengers, Captain Leary said. He grinned. Except for the pretty one, right?
Mistress Grimaud, I said, nodding vigorously. Though I don't know precisely what her position is.
If she'd told you, the captain said, she'd probably have lied.
We'll go down now. No, clean up and put on a suit before we do that. When you're presentable, I'll introduce you to the delegation. Director Jimenez seemed to be concerned that his escort would be a bunch of roughs who'd embarrass the dignity of the foreign ministry.
His smile wasn't altogether warm.
Personally, he went on, I don't believe anything the RCN did could possibly lower it to the level of the foreign ministry. But I figure your experience will put his mind at rest.
I thought of just changing clothes, but I knew I looked like something the cat dragged in. 5 hours working, and I mean working, in an air suit, really takes it out of you. I showered before changing. It made me feel more human as well as cleaner, though I was still very tired. I came back wearing my dull green jacket over gray tunic and slacks.
I knew you'd clean up nice, Captain Leary said. Doesn't he, Hogg?
Pretty as a picture,
his servant said, rising from the striker's seat to take a good look at me.
I hope he can take care of himself.
Now, Hogg, the captain said. It's not going to be that kind of escort. They won't be carrying weapons.
I can take care of myself, Hogg, I said. If he'd been a gentleman, I'd have said Master Hogg, but he wasn't.
But your servant raises a good point, sir. Who have you chosen for the escort?
The captain shrugged.
I figured I'd leave that to you, old Fetri, he said.
Pick any five you'd be comfortable leading on this business.
I started to protest, then caught myself. I wanted to be an officer. This was my job.
Yes, sir, I said. I suppose any of the crew, at least of the former sissies, would stay solid if something went unexpectedly wrong.
They're all former sissies, the captain said, except for you, that is.
He was watching me. There might be a touch of amusement in his eyes. I was pretty sure that he wouldn't let me go too far wrong, though he'd said it was my decision.
The main thing we have to worry about is keeping Director Jimenez happy, I said.
We'll want clean-cut personnel and people who won't scare the civilians, also with a bias towards smart rather than, say, quick, so... I took a couple of seconds to go over my choices one last time. Son and Barnes, I said. I say Barnes instead of Dossie because I know him better and because Dossie's nose is crooked from where it was broken. Weddle and Gamba, in both cases because I've worked with them and trust their judgment. And Wochens, the captain said. Even if Jimenez is as slow as the mid-level foreign ministry staffers I've met have been, I said. Ellie would scare him to death. But I would like Tovera because she wouldn't scare anybody. Captain Leary's face went very still. Have you looked Tovera in the eyes, he said. Yes, I said. Tovera and her mistress were in earshot, but I didn't turn my head. But Jimenez won't. Most people won't. They won't notice her at all. I wouldn't have either, except that Maeve had told me that Mundy's clerk was an assassin. Since then, I'd been watching her. I had no proof that Tovera was what Maeve called her, but the feeling I got from her was certainly that. Tovera isn't under my command, the captain said, so I can't... I can, said Mundy's voice from the speaker on the command console. Tovera is welcome to join Master Olfetri if he wants to have her, and she's amenable, of course. Sure, said Tovera. Mundy was still looking down at her data unit, but Tovera, as always, was scanning the room with an alert expression, like a lizard looking for a meal. I don't expect there'll be any fun, but I never lose hope. The grin that followed the comment would have convinced me that Maeve was right, even if I hadn't already been sure. All right, then, Captain Leary said. Tovera, you'll have to leave your briefcase behind. Son will find you a set of utilities so that you fit in. Olfetri, let's you and I visit our betters. I matched his grin with an equally broad one. The passengers' accommodations on Level 3 probably didn't seem palatial to the civilians, but for somebody who'd gotten used to a cabin barely big enough for its bunk and desk, they certainly seemed so. The captain, or more likely Officer Mundy, must have alerted the delegation that we were coming, because a female servant held open the hatch to what turned out to be a lounge when we came out of the companionway. She bowed as we approached, then closed the panel behind us. Inside were cushioned seats, rather than pressed steel like elsewhere on the ship, and tables with floral designs on the upper surfaces. The only person standing was another servant, this one male. Like the woman at the door, he wore a uniform of brown fabric with a slick finish. Captain Leary, said the man in the chair facing the hatch. The words were an acknowledgement rather than a greeting. He was alone at a table for four. Captain Leary nodded to the seated man. Director Jimenez, I've come to introduce the officer who'll command your escort to the counselor's residence in Jacquerie. This is Lieutenant Olfetri. I stepped forward and bowed. Sir, I said as I straightened. I'm greatly honored to be chosen for this duty. I served an internship in the Bureau of Friendship Affairs. I've always felt that the Foreign Ministry does more to preserve the Republic than any other branch of government. It was true about the internship. Mother had thought the diplomatic service was more refined than the RCN and had pushed to get both her sons into it. Junior had flat refused, but I'd given it a try. It hadn't worked out well. I was quieter than Junior, but I hadn't been willing to solemnly nod when a fool talked nonsense to me. And there were other things. At the time, of course, I'd been a rich man's son looking for a profession rather than a job. You do? Jimenez said, clearly startled. He was a trim little man, perfectly groomed the way you get, only if you spend more time on it than a man ought to spend. Then why are you here? What are you doing here? I shook my head with a sad expression. I couldn't fool myself, sir, I said. I knew within a week that I wasn't fit for the work. I was unwilling to drag down the fine people around me in the department. I was on the Kostroma desk under Director Qualit. I shrugged. I still wanted to serve the Republic, so I joined the Navy, I said, deliberately using the civilian term for the RCN. It was a surprise, a wonderful surprise, to learn that I was posted here. Well, Jimenez said, you're confident that your guards won't embarrass us. You see, Saguntum has no relations whatever with the Republic. Any sort of high-handed behavior, or even the sort of normal loutishness to be expected of spacers, it might absolutely scuttle our mission. Sir, I said, with more truth than most of what I'd been saying, I can honestly tell you that I've hand-picked each person with an eye to intelligence and proper decorum. I regretted that Captain Leary was listening to this. Heaven be thanked that Wochens wasn't. She'd take it as a betrayal. And I had a good notion of how she'd deal with a traitor. Well, said Jimenez. He put a slight emphasis on the word to make it approving. Here am I right as Master Han.
thin, bald man of uncertain age. His face showed no more expression than an insect's does.
He was our finance expert, and on my left, Master Banta, whose specialty is agriculture.
I exchanged nods with both men. Banta was round, very pale, and gave the impression of having the intelligence of a cabbage, which to a degree he resembled. My eyes followed Jimenez's. For the first time since I'd entered, they rested on Maeve. She was an ochre tonight. Smiling, she nodded to me.
"And this is Mistress Grimaud, my secretary," Jimenez said. I nodded to her, then returned my gaze to the director.
"Well, I must say," Jimenez said, "this is much better news than I was expecting. Captain Leary, I congratulate you. I'll make sure my superiors learn how well you've executed their instructions."
Captain Leary bowed, just as I had when I greeted the director. He said,
"Thank you, sir. We of the RCN set great store on the faithful execution of our orders."
We nodded again to the delegates, then left the lounge promptly to go back to where we belonged. I'd have been on the edge of laughter except for one thing, the look in Maeve's eyes as she smiled at me. Maeve moved like a cat. For a moment, she'd made me feel like a mouse.
Chapter 14. The captain and I went from the companionway to the bridge. He to his console, me to stand at parade rest in front of Officer Mundy. She sat as usual with her back to the flat plate display and her attention on the data unit in her lap. Tovera watched me from the jump seat beside her mistress. I was reading amusement into Tovera's expression, but I knew that was me. I wasn't sure that Mundy's servant had feelings.
"Officer Mundy," I said, "to prepare for my escort duties, I would like to see pictures of the members of the counselor's court whom I may be meeting. Can you provide me with such imagery?"
"Yes," said Mundy. I hadn't been sure she was listening to me, but as an afterthought, she looked up at me.
"Would you like dossiers on them as well?"
Yes, very much," I said. "That would be..."
"Take the striker's position," Mundy said. Her hands did something with the control wands. "Hogg has no reason to be there."
Her eyes lifted and held mine for a moment.
"From your performance before Director Jimenez," she said, "I'm surprised that you didn't continue with the Foreign Ministry. You would seem to have a natural aptitude for the work."
I swallowed. Captain Leary hadn't said anything to her. We'd returned to the bridge together.
Mundy must have eavesdropping apparatus in the passenger lounge, and very possibly in every other compartment in the Sunray. I thought of Enery's concern to keep our conversation private.
I smiled. I didn't think I'd said anything I shouldn't have, but there wasn't much I could do about it now anyway.
Aloud, I said, "Officer Mundy, I left shortly after telling Director Qualit that if he didn't take his hand off my thigh, I was going to rip it off and return it through his arsehole. I don't think diplomacy is really one of my strengths."
"I see," Mundy said. Her eyes returned to her holographic display.
"Perhaps you're correct, then."
"Ma'am," I said.
I could be more helpful if I knew what I was really supposed to be doing.
I suppose the tiny movement of Mundy's lips was a smile. She looked at me again. She appeared to be a middle-aged woman without any distinguishing features, but every atom of her being was precise. She reminded me of a chronometer or a target pistol.
"What you're supposed to do, Olfetri," she said, "is to be yourself. To behave as you would normally behave, that's all."
I wanted to shout, "I don't understand," which would have been just as pointless as it was true. Instead, I nodded and said, "Thank you, Officer Mundy," and took the saddle at the back of the console. Og had moved to an open seat across the bridge from Tovera. The data Mundy had offered waited for me as a glowing icon on the striker's display. I began sifting through it. There were about 40 personnel all told, including members of the Saguntine government, the members of the bureaucracy who would be negotiating with our passengers, prominent business people, and, to my surprise, members of the Karst observation mission to Saguntum. I should have expected that. I knew that though Saguntum was independent in most realms, her foreign policy was wholly under the control of Karst. The chief executive of Saguntum was called the Counselor. He was elected for life from the Board of Advisors, of whom he had to be a male member. The counselor for the past 15 years was Israel Perez. He'd succeeded his uncle, and before that the counselor had been his grandfather. Israel was 40, intellectual-looking and had a receding forehead. There was nothing surprising about any of that. The surprise came with the second person, Colonel Eugene Folliot, the director of public safety. Folliot's picture showed a man of over 50, clean-shaven and hard.
He wore a civilian suit of thin blue stripes, but he'd have looked more at home in uniform. Before coming to Saguntum 15 years ago and allying himself with the new counselor Perez, Foliat had been chief of the governing board, ruler of Garofalo. He left Garofalo after a coup. "Officer Mundy," I said, opening a link to her position. "This is Olfetri. I have a question about the information you sent me. Over." "Go ahead, Olfetri," Mundy said through the console. "You want to know why Perez trusts Foliat, I suppose?" She didn't close the statement, but I could see that she'd stopped talking. I said, "Well, yes, ma'am. Why anybody would trust Foliat, I guess. If he was ousted by a coup himself, surely it'd be natural for him to at least consider returning to power the same way." "Quite reasonable, granting the initial premise," Mundy said, "which is incorrect. Foliat wasn't ousted by his chancellor's coup. He survived the bomb explosion which killed his wife, and he carried out a purge of the plotters with a thoroughness that Speaker Leary would have approved. It's reported that he personally executed several of the leading plotters, and also the technician who placed the bomb. Foliat was quite attached to his wife." If I hadn't made a point of keeping my mouth closed, I'd have been gaping. When I decided that Mundy had finished speaking, I said, "Ma'am, if he'd won, why did Foliat leave Garofalo? Was he afraid there'd be another coup?" Mundy shrugged where she sat, though she didn't look up at me. "You'll have to ask him yourself when you see him," she said. "If I were speculating, I would suspect that he felt uncomfortable about doing what he felt necessary after the coup he'd survived." Suddenly she did look at me. "There's no evidence that Speaker Leary regretted his similar actions, however." "I see," I said. "Thank you, Officer Mundy. Olfetri out." There was more to what Mundy had said than was in her words, but I didn't know what it was. She had been referring to the Three Circles conspiracy, but that had taken place before I was born. I could look it up on the console's database, but I might as well ask Mundy directly, since certainly she would learn about any search I made on the Sunray. It sounded like a minefield, and it seemed a much better idea for me to leave it alone. I resumed reading about the Saguntine government. "Saguntum Orbital Control, we are preparing to land," Corey announced. Orbital Control was a tug with no interstellar capacity, and additional sensors and communications gear added. "Break. Ship, prepare for landing. Braking for landing, now." Corey slammed the high drive on hard. I had an image of Jackery Harbor set at the center bottom of my display. It began to swell, though that was a computer effect, in between samples of real imagery from the sensors when the orbit permitted it. I was in the stern station, seated at the flat plate display alongside Lieutenant Ennery. My hand was poised over the switch that would return our landing to computer control if Corey and Ennery were simultaneously struck dead. Even a disaster of vanishingly small likelihood wasn't going to make me capable of a manual landing in crisis conditions. For several seconds, the thrusters added their braking effort to that of the high drives. Then the high drive buzzing vanished, and even the roar of the thrusters became lost in the shaking and rattling of the atmospheric buffeting as the Sunray plunged deeper toward the surface. Beside me, Ennery had her fingers on the virtual throttles at the base of her display. She was prepared to take over manually if something happened to Corey. I'd seen how skillful she was when she landed on Hansen's world, so I didn't doubt that she could do it. And yet, it was just a form of bragging. There was no point in it, and no point in Corey choosing to make a manual landing to begin with. There were circumstances where a manual landing was a good idea. When the landing had to be made on a hard surface, a skilled human could ease the ship in more gently than a computer would when billowing steam didn't swaddle the hull in the final approach. Jackery had a well-appointed harbor, and at present it wasn't even crowded. Maybe Corey felt that practice made perfect. More likely he was bragging, and Ennery was ready to play the same game. And why had I decided to join the RCN? Sure, now it was a job with a real chance of advancement. But at the time I decided to enter the academy, I was the son of a wealthy entrepreneur who moved to the highest levels of the Republic. I could have spent my life in study and leisure activities, or in drunken debauchery, like the sons of most of my dad's intimates. Corey brought the Sunray into balance with gravity at 200 feet. Then eased her to the surface. For a moment, I thought we were drifting. Then I realized that Corey had hovered us to the mouth of the slip and was slanting us in bow foremost. As the thruster exhaust licked the harbor, steam shrouded the Sunray and hit our surroundings in the optical range. I manually switched to active imaging, microwave, as we slid neatly into our berth. It had been a lovely piece of work. The thruster shut down, though the slap of water beneath the walls of the slip continued to buffet us as the environment cooled. I took my fingers from the controls and let out a deep breath. I was where I wanted to be. If choosing to be a member of the RCN was a form of bragging, so be it. It was something worth bragging about. Chapter 15. The cabin of the limousine which the Saguntines provided for the officials had room for six. I waited while they entered. Maeve Grimaud sat primly with her back to the driver, facing the three men from the foreign ministry. The vehicle was old, probably of off-planet manufacture, but it had been lovingly maintained, or possibly restored. The locals had provided an armored personnel carrier for me and the escort. It moved on wheels like the limousine, but it was much newer and was locally built. Sun chatted with the vehicle commander in the cupola about the APC's automatic impeller. I watched the limousine following us through the armored glass. I'd opened the steel shutter in the rear gate. I didn't know what I could do if something had happened to the limousine, but I guess I had to worry about something. The APC had ports in the sides through which I got glimpses of Jacquerie, sepia-toned by the thick glass. It looked pretty ordinary. Along our route it had been mostly one- and two-story structures, with businesses on the ground floor and apartments on the higher level. There'd been a handful which were tall enough that I couldn't see the tops through the windows, but I was pretty sure four stories was as high as anything got here. We drove past a stone-faced building set back behind a plaza. Our APC slowed to a halt. There were full-height pilasters set into the facade, and a pair of ornamental-looking guards at the entrances. Civilians on the plaza lounged in the shade of trees in big pots. I fumbled to open the gate, but Sun reached past me and dropped the ramp with a clang of steel on stone. We trotted out and were standing beside the limo before the Saguntine staff, a driver and his assistant, got the passenger doors open. Sun grinned at me and said, "That was a combat release. The hydraulics would have taken forever, and I didn't think you wanted to wait." "Too bloody right," I muttered, as Director Jimenez got out gracefully. He had experience doing that sort of thing. The driver's assistant whispered to me, "I'll guide you if you like, sir." I nodded, because I certainly would like. With Sun beside me and the four ministry people strung out behind us, we walked to the entrance. The rest of my spacers brought up the rear. Maeve was in a black suit whose flowing trouser legs could have been a skirt to look at. The tailored jacket she wore over the dark gray tunic was completely demure, but a prostitute on the strip outside Harbor 3 couldn't have looked more alluring. "Wait here one moment, please," my guard said. He spoke to a civilian just inside the entrance. The guard's weapons were chromed. That didn't mean they wouldn't work, but neither of the men in green and gold uniforms struck me as the sort I wanted behind me if things got rough. I guess Sun thought the same, because he muttered in my ear, "Pretty little fellers, aren't they?" "What's going on?" Jimenez demanded in a peevish voice. Our guide returned and said, to me and the director both, "It'll be just a minute," and, from inside but clearly audible, boomed the loudest unamplified voice I'd ever heard. "Your Grace, allow me to introduce Director Oleg Jimenez of the Republic of Cinnabar and the members of his honorable delegation." Sun and I moved fast to lead Jimenez inside. Beyond the anteroom was a large hall in which about 40 people stood in small clumps. At the front were two desks, one facing the entrance and the other at right angles where two female clerks worked. Counselor Perez, I recognized him from his picture, stood up behind the desk facing us. He was wearing a business suit. "Greetings, Director Jimenez," Perez said. "You are welcome on your own behalf and in the name of the great republic you represent. Please come forward." The director and his two male associates walked through the assembly. In the big room, it was too sparse to be called a crowd. I gestured to my spacers to stop. Until I was told otherwise, we were going to wait at the back of the hall and remain unobtrusive. Jimenez and Perez spoke when they met beside the desk. After a moment, Perez turned to the general audience and said, "My friends, Director Jimenez and his companions are going to join me briefly in my private office. I'll return shortly." "What's that about?" Sun whispered to me, as Perez let the delegate through a door in the wall behind his desk. I started to shrug, then really thought about the question. "More bloody nonsense," I whispered back. "But they're dressing it up to look like something. I don't know how much trade there even could be between us and Saguntum, but Cinnabar is big and Perez wants to be polite. When the door to the private office closed, there was motion and a louder buzz of conversation in the hall. A table with glasses and pitchers stood in a corner. The pitchers probably held water, but Sun and the other spacers drifted hopefully in that direction anyway. I stayed where I was, but the fact that other people were moving allowed me to see faces where there'd been only the backs of heads before. I saw several people whom Mundy's dossiers described as business leaders, and against the back wall, on the side opposite the door to the private office, was Colonel Folliot, in civilian clothes. He was talking to a younger man in uniform. The uniform wasn't quite battle dress, but neither was it a comic opera outfit like those of the guards at the entrance. I felt motion in the corner of my eye. I glanced left. Representative McKinnon, the head of the Karst observation mission, was smiling at my side. I didn't like the smile, nor the pudgy man with thinning sandy hair if it came to that. "So," McKinnon said. He was holding a glass about half full of water. "What are you really here for, then?" "Sir," I said. "Oh, we're spacers from the Sunray. We're escorting those diplomats who just went in with the boss here. I guess we'll escort them back to the ship when they're done talking." "Yes. But what is the Sunray really doing on Saguntum?" McKinnon said. "You surely don't think I'm fool enough to believe your story about a trade delegation." It wasn't hard for me to act like an ignorant spacer. I wasn't quite ignorant enough not to know McKinnon was trying to pump me, but it was simpler to pretend to be. I said, "Sir, I don't know you well enough to think anything about you." I offered my right hand to shake and added, "I'm Royal Fetri, third officer on the Sunray. And you?" McKinnon made a noise in his throat and turned on his heel. I thought for an instant that he was going to slap my hand away. If he'd done that, I was going to give him my left in the pit of his stomach. That might have caused trouble when Director Jimenez learned about it, which didn't concern me. Or when I reported it to Captain Leary, whose opinion did matter. But I'd asked Officer Mundy how I was supposed to behave, and she'd said clearly that I was supposed to be myself. If you hit me, you'd better expect to be hit back. Besides, I didn't think an RCN officer was required to let himself be assaulted by foreigners. If I was wrong about that, it was a good thing that I'd dropped out of the academy. Maeve had remained in the rear of the hall when her colleagues went into conference with Counselor Perez. She'd been watching with a smile. Now she came over and said, "You don't seem to have hit it off with the gentleman from Karst, Master Olfetri." "He wanted me to talk about things I don't know about," I said, my eyes on McKinnon's back. "And we're none of his business anyway." Maeve chuckled. "Well, I wouldn't bet about it being none of his business," she said. "He's Karst's chief spy on Saguntum, but it's certainly not your business to answer him." She cocked her head. She said, "You know, Roy, it's still all right to call you Roy, isn't it?" I remembered the way we'd last parted. "Sure," I said. "And me to call you Maeve, I hope?" "Of course," she said warmly. "I was wondering if you had plans for after this levy," she added, gesturing around the room with her left hand. "Well, I'm still on duty after I get my people back to the ship," I said. "Can you get off?" Maeve said. "I'd like to have dinner with a pleasant companion for a change." "Well, I probably can," I said. "I don't know anything about restaurants in Jacquerie, though." Maeve laughed again. "No matter," she said. "I have quite a number of contacts here. I think the best choice would be to eat in my hotel and then decide what to do afterward." I started to ask what she meant by my hotel, but the door to the private office opened. Counselor Perez came out and spoke to one of the clerks at the other desk, while the three Cinnabar delegates filed past him and returned to where I waited. I'd formed up my five spacers. "Han will be going back to the ship with you, Olfetri," Jimenez said. "He'll arrange the transport of the delegation's baggage here. The delegation is moving to the palace for the duration of our stay." "Ah," I said. "Sir, what shall I tell Captain Leary?"
"Tell him," said the director. "I don't see that you need to tell him anything. His orders are to transport me and to provide any assistance I require. I assure you that when I require something, I'll let Leary know."
"Thank you, sir," I said, bowing. "Were you told what vehicle we were to return in?"
"That's really none of my concern, Lieutenant," Jimenez said, and led Master Banter to the pair of clerks in the front of the room. Not a man I warmed to.
I looked at Master Han, who had no expression at all.
"Sir," I said, "let's go out and I'll see if I can raise a vehicle."
Han bowed to me.
"I will be glad to travel with you, Lieutenant," he said.
was struck that Han had been given the job of getting the baggage together rather than Maeve. It seemed more like a secretary's job, but she was seeming less and less like a secretary. With Han and my spacers in tow, I went back onto the plaza. Our guide waited there. The limo had vanished, but the armored vehicle remained.
"Sir," I said, "can the APC run us back to the ship? And we've got one of the delegation, too, but there's room for him in the box if it isn't a problem with you."
"No problem, sir," said the guide.
I'd thought of him as the assistant driver, but he seemed to be the senior man in the limo, my counterpart, the head of the Saguntine escort.
"Roy, I wonder if I could come back to the port with you," Maeve said, smiling toward the local as she spoke to me. "The restaurant is in walking distance, so we can leave from there when you've gotten approval from your captain."
The guide met my eyes.
"Of course," he said. Then he winked.
I hadn't noticed the noise on the way to the palace. I did on the ride back. The engine was loud, the hard tires drummed the pavement, and the armored body rang at 1,000 points of contact with its own elements. I was glad of that, because it was an excuse not to talk with Maeve in front of the spacers I commanded. I wasn't sure what she might say, and I was even less sure of what I wanted her to say.
Captain Leary was absent. Lieutenant Ennery checked the log and said, "Once your escort duties are finished, you're all off duty till 0600. Isn't that what Captain Leary told you?"
"Yes, ma'am," I said, and went down to the crew's quarters to relay the news. The enlisted spacers were already heading out. They'd been told the same thing I had, and they believed it.
Well, why shouldn't they?
I changed into a different suit, brown with russet patches, and met Maeve on the bridge. She'd changed also into a tan suit that matched mine rather nicely. I wondered if that was chance. It just about had to be chance because I'd made my choice when I returned to my cabin, but I didn't say anything. As we started across the boarding bridge, even the extension was wide enough for two abreast if they were careful. Maeve said, "How many different suits did you bring, Roy?"
"It was bring them or let them be sold out of pawn," I said, knowing I sounded offensive. Then, because I hadn't answered the question, I said, "There's six of them, I guess. They were comfortable, so why not?"
"No reason whatever," Maeve said.
I may have been inventing the laughter I thought I heard under the words. She made me uncomfortable, and I was pretty sure that she was doing that deliberately. I thought of Rachel, my fiancée, until the bottom dropped out of my prospects. I wondered what Rachel was doing now, and I hated myself for caring.
"Here's the place," Maeve said as we crossed the second street up from the harbor.
The building ahead of us was four stories. The bar on the corner was the Fountain, with a neon sign on which a blue fountain mounted to the top of a green frame before sinking back to the base. In the middle of the block was a separate entrance with a doorman. The bronze letters above that door were externally lighted and read, "The St. James."
"The restaurant is through here," Maeve said, angling toward the bar. "Though we could reach it through the hotel also," she glanced up at me and said. "But I thought we'd eat first."
"Yes," I said, determinedly not meeting her eyes. We entered. It seemed a decent place with half a dozen customers at present. The barman caught our eyes, but Maeve waved cheerfully to him and started up the staircase in the back. She certainly did have contacts in Jacquerie.
"Two, please, Jean," she said to the greeter. "A quiet booth, if we could."
"It's a quiet night, Mistress Grimaud," the greeter said. "But we'd find something for you regardless. Come with me, please." The greeter bowed Maeve into a banquette seat. "Have you been here many times?" I asked as I slid into the other side.
"Well, no. I've never been on Saguntum before this mission," Maeve said. "But when I learned I'd be living in this hotel, I made a point of introducing myself to the staff I'd be dealing with."
"And feeing them very heavily ahead of time," I realized, though I didn't say that aloud. I didn't care about that. It was foreign ministry money. If they were wasting it, that was their business. But it did make me wonder what Maeve expected to get for her money. She didn't strike me like the sort who would be that concerned about a good table in a restaurant.
"The chicken here is supposed to be very good," Maeve volunteered, when the waiter arrived to take our order. "But she let me make my choice first and then got the same thing, a house specialty."
Maeve asked for the wine list. Though I said I wasn't much of a drinker, she ordered a bottle rather than individual glasses. As we waited for our entrees, Maeve smiled in the dim light and said,
"You know, you're really quite a handsome young fellow, Roy. I hope you don't mind my saying that."
"I don't mind," I said, sipping my wine. I'd let her fill the goblet. "I think you're wrong, though."
Maeve laughed.
In the same voice as before, as though she weren't changing the subject, she said, "What do you think of the Navy and politics, Roy?" I didn't choke on the wine, but I put the goblet down before I said, "Ma'am, I'm glad the RCN isn't in politics." "That's not true, you know," Maeve said calmly.